You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Welcome, everybody, and thanks for being here. And I'm certainly glad that this is not yesterday, because if it was yesterday and the rain had been pouring, we would have a nice chat among ourselves. But it's a beautiful day, and of course that sometimes is another reason why people don't travel. But for this event, we never had any worries. We have with us Jean Pisani-Ferry, who is, I would say, of course, one of the leading French economists, but also European economists, global economists. Washington is very much also home for him. And he has written this book on the Euro crisis and its aftermath. We have copies outside for those who want to get it. It really is a wonderful book, and I think it will give us the opportunity to talk about Europe, looking backward a little bit, the key analytical points in evaluating the crisis, but I hope also very much looking forward. And then we will have Jörg de Cressin, who is at the IMF, who is now in the Europe Department, but was for a long time managing the VO, who will give his reactions. And I just discovered that Jörg was German, so we have the French-German-European motor here at Brookings. Jean, in his book, quotes a 14th-century French philosopher, Nicolas Orem, who wrote, I'm quoting from John's book, of course, "Money does not belong to the prince, but to the community." And I think that, you know, that sentence is so important, I think, when one discusses and thinks about the euro. Because at the end of the day, money has to be accepted by the community that is using it. That is the primary fundamental basis for it to work. And I think as we look at the euro, we have to keep that in mind. I also would say that we are having this get-together at a time when the degree of optimism about the eurozone and Europe and the European economy is quite a bit higher than it was about a year ago, of course. You probably remember that up to about 6 months ago, 8 months ago, but certainly in 2012, the large majority of economic analysts here in Washington, at least, but not only in Washington, thought that Greece would exit the euro. Many thought that, in fact, the euro was more or less going to collapse. So now that has receded in the background. We had the deputy governor of the Bank of Greece here the other day giving us a talk. And they took a recent poll in Greece after all the suffering, after all the problems. 70% of the Greek citizens actually want to stay in the eurozone. So, it's quite a telling, I think, message that many citizens give, that they may have problems with Europe. They certainly have huge problems of unemployment, of social problems, livelihood problems, youth unemployment. But at the same time, I think the commitment to the euro today, both at the political high level, but even among citizens, is still very high. And I think this is one of the themes that we should discuss. 2 days ago, we watched the first ever so-called presidential debate in connection with the elections to the European Parliament. As you probably know, most of you, the Lisbon Treaty stipulates that while the Council of Leaders nominates the President of the Commission, it has to do so taking into account the elections for the European Parliament. And, you know, by chance, I've kind of found out that it was streamed on Euronews and we watched it. And it was interesting because despite all the problems and all the suffering and all the, you know, big challenges faced, and despite the fact that perhaps none of the candidates that were debating there will end up being president, there was some real energy there. And one point made by the candidates was, after all this election, this dynamic, this talk, and the leaders, after all, did endorse these candidates. It's not that these candidates just themselves, you know, appeared out of thin air. It would not be that easy to say to Europe, well, fine, you've had that was a nice entertainment, but now let's go back to serious matters and choose the people we want in our usual horse trading. So there are lots of things, I think, in store for us over the next few months. And reading Jean's book, I think, is one of the best preparations one can have in following what was happening, analyzing what is possible and what the various options are, and being engaged in what is both politically so interesting but also economically so challenging, and yet at the end of the day, until now, despite all the crisis, quite successful venture. So with that, I'm going to turn it to Jean, who's going to talk for about 15, 20 minutes, and then York will give his perspective, and then we'll have a discussion. Jean, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much, Kemal. It's really good to be back here. I remember several debates in this room about the same issues. And today we have the privilege of being able to look back, discuss, without being caught in the smoke and fire of immediate concerns. When I first published the French version of what became a much longer, much more developed English book, I remember the publisher was very fast, and 2 months after I gave the manuscript, it was on the shelves. And I was very nervous about these 2 months. I thought it was really extremely long and that so many things could happen. With all regard to the quality of the work of Oxford University Press, it's almost a year since I gave the manuscript to them. And I wasn't so nervous about what could happen during that year. So it's an indication that times have changed and that we are, I mean, in a different environment where we can reflect and think and not only discuss what's the next hurdle to come. The book is not a book defending a particular thesis. It's a book that tries to provide an analytical account of what happened, of the euro crisis and the debates about it. This crisis was a true discovery process. It was a discovery process because many things had been said, discussed beforehand, and many of the events that unfold just were an illustration of what had been said before. That was, so, you know, to borrow from the famous quote, this was the known unknowns of the euro crisis. But there were also unknowns, things that we really discovered during this crisis and that raised questions about how monetary union works, but some even more fundamentally, how the economy works. And that was what was very interesting in this crisis. And there were also political dimensions, and those political dimensions, they were extremely important throughout the process. You mentioned this quote from the 14th century philosopher, Nicolas Oresme, but you did not mention that I borrowed the quote from Hans Dittmeier. Hans Dittmeier, the former Bundesbank president, at the time when there was a discussion about whether or not to go for a common currency, a monetary union, he used to say that money is something really important, and that to justify the independence of the central bank, he used to say that money belongs to the community, it does not belong to the prince, and therefore it has to be kept at a distance from the prince. But for Europe, the question was, what is this community? What's the community that is going to underpin the building of the single currency? And there were long discussions before the project started about what would create this community. The German had a concept for it. This was political union. And by political union, they meant institutional investment that would create this community. But they didn't know exactly what they meant by political union. It was more a concept than a plan for anything specific. The French had their own expression for it. It was called gouvernement économique. And it was sort of the equivalent in the French culture of the political union. In a centralized culture, they thought, you know, what creates a community is a government. So we need a government to create a community. But they were absolutely unclear also about what they meant by the gouvernement economic government. And in the end, the euro was created without having forged a community. And what was discovered also in this crisis was that the fact that this money was interest currency was introduced did not by itself create a community. That was one of the mistakes that were made, to believe that by the fact that we would share a currency, we would de facto have a sense of community that would be created by the currency. The currency did not create it. What happened is that having done so much to introduce a currency, to delegate those new powers to Frankfurt and in part to Brussels, national governments reacted by emphasizing where they were still in control and therefore refusing to go any further in terms of delegation of power because they thought, we have made such a big investment, we have made such a big concession by giving all those powers to Frankfurt and Brussels that we want to keep the rest for us at home. So, in fact, it was almost the opposite reaction after the introduction of the currency. Perhaps the period was a bit short to judge. Perhaps this creation of a community, it's a matter for centuries rather than decades. But at least in the short time span between the introduction of the currency and the crisis, the sort of mechanism that would have created a community did not take place. When the crisis started in 2010, and as it unfolded, it became clear that there were several views of why it happened and what were the underlying problems. There were essentially three views that developed. One was the sort of Northern European view, that essentially the design was good, but the enforcement had been weak. So it was a crisis of enforcement of the commonly agreed rules. The Maastricht Treaty was not to be challenged, but that essentially there had been a failure of enforcement. And there is much to say for this thesis, obviously, because Greece is a sort of paradigmatic example of a country that signed to the single currency but did not abide by the rule. One may wonder what would have happened had Ireland been the first country to request financial assistance, because Ireland was a completely different case. Ireland was a country that had an impeccable fiscal record. It was a country that had also a very flexible labor market. I mean, Ireland on many accounts were just ticking the boxes. But it was Greece. And so the perception, the narrative about the crisis was it's a crisis of lack of enforcement of the rules. Now, the second reading is the one that is very common in the city and in U.S. universities. That's it was a bad idea to start with, that it was not a matter of design. It was a matter of why it was created and what was the purpose and how it was assumed that a single currency would work with very different economies, with a very weak adjustment mechanisms between these economies. So basically, you know, that the fact that it was born not to be an optimum currency area, that this was known, and that it would end up in difficulties. Perhaps the clearest and at the time the most derided exposition of this view was the paper by Martin Feldstein 97 EMU and international conflict, where he went as far as saying it's going to create acrimony and conflict between participating countries. But he went one step further, but many academics held the view that there was a mistake in the conception, in the very purpose. And again, it's hard to dispute that, and this was known from the start, that the EMU was not an optimum currency area, that the adjustment mechanism were weak. Again, there was some confidence in the fact that over time, sort of endogenously, it would develop into an optimum currency area. This was this view put forward by Andrew Rose and Jeff Frankel. Eventually, it did not by the simple mechanism of integration. Integration did not develop much, actually. Trade integration developed much less than anticipated. And market integration more broadly was not pushed by governments, again, because they had the feeling that they had transferred already much too much to Brussels and that they wanted to keep control of what remained. So this view, again, has something to it, even though it went too far when predicting that EMU would not be created and then that the euro would explode. It's underestimated the political will in Europe to create it and to stick to it once it had been created. The third view is a view that's essentially is associated with sort of pro-Europeans and in some respect with the French and Southern Europe views, which was that it was not so much a failure of fiscal discipline, it was not so much a matter of a wrong idea, but it was a matter of incomplete integration. And that it was the failure to go further and to complement the euro as it was with other dimensions, be it the banking union, be it a system of economic governance, be it further integration in certain field, that created the problem, the crisis exposed. And perhaps, you know, if you think of country like Spain, like Ireland, you would say that problems there were not of a fiscal origin. They were much more of problems having with the banking sector, with the lack of domestic supervision of the banking sector, but also with the lack of a banking union, with the lack of a more European approach to these issues. So the financial side of the monetary union was not there, and that was part of the problem. Those three views are not incompatible, but each of them points to a different direction for things that need to be achieved. And they can provide guideposts for reading the debates that we've had, the debate about crisis management, the debate about austerity, the debate about exit. So to continue, question is, why has it been so difficult when the crisis happened to find responses, to find solutions? And you can read the crisis as a... And I do the book is that I tell the history of the crisis episode after episode. And when you do that, it's very clear that the responses were delayed and delayed. There was an attempt to convince market that half-backed solutions were full solution, that compromises were agreements. And this contributed to the aggravation step after step of this real crisis. And I think many of us, going through these episodes, essentially perceived the unfolding of events as always Europe being one step behind the curve, being 1 euro short, and so on, being hopelessly unable to raise to the challenge and define responses at the corresponding to the magnitude of the problem that were it was dealing with. A charitable view of things is that by the standards of international diplomacy, things went very fast. I mean, if you just look at what was agreed, the new fiscal treaty, the design of an assistance mechanism, which also required a new treaty, all the reforms of surveillance, the banking union, etc., all that went extremely fast by any standard known, you know, in Europe and beyond. But this is a too charitable view, even though it's true, because we were confronted with events that went at incredible speed and with incredible force, and so you have to measure the performance against the strength, the force of what you were confronted to, and the risks, which were at some point absolutely vital, lethal. And also, if you look back and ask yourself, what has been the cost of this mismanagement, taking into account both the prevention and the crisis management, the cost has been obviously huge. We're speaking of a lost decade in Southern Europe. It measures up to the Latin American lost decade in terms of GDP per capita being 10 years later at the same level as it was at the beginning of the decade. We're speaking of unemployment rates that are now three times higher in Southern Europe than they are in Northern Europe. For young people, they're five times higher. We're speaking of an acrimony among European citizens about what should be done that you're going to see the result of in the election, with the fringe, the anti-European party, certainly having a strong showing in some countries. You're speaking of a weakening of Europe in the eyes of the rest of the world. So all that is important. So it's a bit too charitable to say, oh, yes, it took time, with respect to the crisis momentum, not with respect to the standards of international diplomacy. I think has to be said is that all these delays, all these partial responses, and I could go through all of them, they basically resulted from the fact that this crisis was in fact also a constitutional crisis for the euro area. What we had to revisit were all the compromises, all the agreements for which there were different interpretations depending on the country, and that were extremely difficult to revisit. So it was not a difficulty of simply agreeing on something or just deciding in the same way you would say, let's decide on an IMF program for country X or country Y, which is basically an executive decision about implementing an existing mechanism to a particular case. There were some fundamental questions each time. What is the no bailout clause, for example? There was this view that you don't bail out governments. What does it mean exactly? So going back to the treaty, you find a sentence, you have different interpretations. Some people say it means there is no assistance whatsoever. Some people say the sentence in the treaty does not legally exclude financial assistance. And that's fundamentally a constitutional issue. How do you interpret the rules of the game? The same happens to the debt restructuring. Is debt restructuring part of what could happen in a monetary union or not? The Greek debt restructuring was the first restructuring of a sovereign debt since the war in an advanced country. So for some people, it was really changing the rules, the implicit rules of the game, that the definition of an advanced country is that it does not restructure its debt, that it serves its debt without any accident. And that's a common property of advanced country, of European countries, that a safe asset is a safe asset. Revisiting that meant deciding whether you had to accept that a safe asset was not exactly what you thought before. And again, this gave rise to many discussions. So different interpretations, different philosophies, and against the background, as I said, of different readings of the crisis, different narratives of the crisis that captured the public opinion in Northern Europe, the perception that it was all about others flouting the rules, in Southern Europe that it was all about the system that was wrong and working against them. And in these conditions, you had to find solution. So it's time to wrap up, as Kemal Kandlis tells me. So time to wrap up, and I'm not going to develop on what is to be done now, because that's, I suppose, what you're going to ask us to discuss. Let me just say that the question ahead of us, the questions ahead of us, are probably as important and as difficult as the question that we have solved. The question ahead of us are questions about the degree of integration, about some of these unresolved constitutional issues, because some were resolved, but some haven't been resolved. I mean, on the bailout, for example, we still don't have a very clear answer about what are the rules of the game. They are about governance. And they are also, obviously, starting from where we are, about the conditions in which we're going to return to prosperity in Europe, because I'm very interested, and I think that those issues of systemic designs are fundamental, but what is of interest to most people is when are we going to recreating jobs? When is the adjustment going to... You have it? Okay. So when is it that we're going to start reversing the divergence and start returning prosperity? So those are issues, unfortunately, I haven't had time to address now, but I'm sure we're going to address them in the discussion.
Thank you. The subject is vast. Thank you. The IMF also embarked in an amazing journey. So give us a little bit, not just, Europe, but also for the IMF, what did it mean?
Yes, I'll talk briefly about that in my remarks. I wanted to first revisit the book. I thought there's a lot of economics books that I received that die a slow death on my bedside table. This one arrived via email in my inbox in the office. I thought, let me have a quick look at it, and then proceeded to neglect all my duties for a whole afternoon, and I was done with almost two-thirds of the book, and then I thought, I may as well throw in the next morning, and I was through with it, and it was a wonderful book, a very delightful and insightful read that I can very strongly recommend. Very accessible, very readable. So what I'll try to do is briefly, in my remarks, cover some of his theses and my views on them, frame it around three questions. What went wrong, why, and what to do about it. And to do so, what I propose to do with you is compare the euro area crisis with the U.S. crisis. So, as we know, it takes two to tango. It takes at least two to have a party, and you can argue that both the U.S. and the euro area had a credit party. In both the U.S. and the euro area, there were over-optimistic borrowers and imprudent lenders. In both the U.S. and the euro area, there were some regions that borrowed more, where the party was stronger than in other regions. And in both the U.S. and in the euro area, the party ended with a terrible hangover. But it seems like the U.S. got over this hangover a good deal better than the euro area. So the question is why? And I submit three factors that I draw out of the book. The first is, you need to think of the euro area as a collection of countries, not a collection of states as in the U.S. The lenders in the crisis were mostly located in one specific area. These were the banks of Germany and France, and they lent to banks and people in the periphery, Ireland, Spain, Portugal, and Greece. And it seems that in the end, the lenders thought of themselves mostly as Germans and French, and the borrowers mostly as Spaniards, Portuguese, Greek, and Irish people. So by comparison, in the U.S., no one looked at the U.S. credit crisis as a crisis where people from Maine ended up bailing out people from Florida. So in the U.A. it was different, and it reflects the fact that all politics in the end is local politics. And it also reflects the fact that there is no effective euro area-wide political accountability. So that was reason number one. Reason number two is simply bad euro area crisis management and resolution. And here, Jean, in his book, writes, the truth is that the whole issue of crisis management had been left aside in the Maastricht negotiations. Very true. In the U.S., there is the Fed. It's the lender of last resort. It acts in concert with the FDIC and the Treasury. Where things in the crisis did not work very well, such as with investment banks, solutions were found relatively quickly. In the euro area, by contrast, no such mechanisms existed. The ECB is not a lender of last resort. At national levels, most countries did not have effective ways to take banks out of business. There were, even at the national level, no bank-specific insolvency frameworks in most countries, let alone at the euro area level. So what did we have? We had decentralized crisis management and resolution, which resulted in a big mess. When the crisis struck, it was all about externalizing liabilities and internalizing assets. So core banks and bondholders withdrew their funds from the periphery, and the ECB was sent in to lend instead. That was, to put it mildly, suboptimal, but one can argue that the ECB did the best it could out of a terrible hand it was dealt. So that was reason number two, crisis management and resolution. Reason number three is, and that's important, the narrative of the crisis. As Jean put it, it will never be known how things would have been if Brian Cowan, the Irish Prime Minister, had requested help first, before his Greek colleague, Georges Papandreou. We all know Ireland had run prudent fiscal policy, had seen strong growth, strong export growth. It could not be faulted for violating the Stability and Growth Pact, which at least nominally was the most important set of rules governing the functioning of the euro area. The same holds for Spain. Portugal is a bit of a mixed bag. It met the pact in terms of the letter, but perhaps not in terms of the spirit. But it was Greece which came first. And Greece was facing a fiscal crisis. And even worse, it appeared that the country had met the criteria for joining European Monetary Union on the basis of false data. So this transformed the entire story from one of imprudent private borrowers and imprudent private lenders to one of badly run countries that did not play by the rules, taking advantage of well-run countries that had played by the rules. So we can now, over these three reasons, have a long debate. Was this fundamental problem political, or was the fundamental problem simply that there was too much faith being put in the private sector? In any case, the upshot of these three reasons is that not only did the people in the core economies fail to appreciate the role played by their own banks in fueling the credit party in the periphery, they also failed to appreciate the extent to which their own banks offloaded risk on the balance sheet of the ECB. And even worse, people in the core now thought that because bad fiscal policy made a major contribution to the crisis, solving the crisis required mainly a good dose of fiscal adjustment. In short, what was mainly a financial crisis between private borrowers and private lenders became to be seen as a fiscal crisis caused by the public sector. Instead of borrowers and lenders pitted against one another, like in the U.S., it was a story of governments and countries pitted against one another. Now, the narrative of the crisis critically shapes its resolution. So the questions are, why did a more nuanced reading of this narrative not emerge? Was it because the European leaders didn't understand? Was it that the less nuanced crisis suited their preferences? Was it because they didn't know how to deal with banks and simply pushed the problems onto the sovereigns? Or was it the powerful banks themselves? One could probably raise a few more questions, but I already don't know the answers to these. So now, the issue is, where to go from here? Where to go from here? So Jean lays out four questions that Europe must answer. First, is the euro area willing to embrace more product, labor, and capital market integration? Second, is it ready to consider more risk sharing between different countries, including a framework to deal with sovereign default? Third, is it ready for a federal budget? Fourth, is it ready for institutional reform and better decision making? So the answers that seem to be emerging to these questions are qualified yeses to some of them. Okay, let me try to sum up how Jean puts it. On more integration, there is a project for banking union, and it can greatly help to integrate Europe's financial markets. So progress on number one. On number two, risk sharing between governments, we now have the European Stability Mechanism. This is a major step forward. On number three, the federal budget, nothing has really changed. On better decision making, let's just say nothing much has really changed either. Jean concludes, this is perhaps the longest sentence you will find in the book, and translate that he is a politician after all. In the near term, this may well prove sufficient to contain risks. In practical terms and for the short term, the difference between the reforms that could be implemented and those that are being or will be implemented is less significant than it seems. Okay? So let me conclude here with just a few remarks on one proposal that Jean makes in the book, which is Eurobonds. And he proposes those as a European safe asset and says that obviously they would have to come with a system based on ex ante control of national budgets, of the budget deficit, not of spending and taxing, right? That is that should be left to the countries. So what I wonder is how can you enforce good fiscal behavior between sovereign nations, including between some nations that are just simply too big to fail? I want to say again, I think that for the most part, the nations in the euro area have followed reasonably prudent fiscal policy. I would say in many dimensions, fiscal policy was better than in the US and in the UK in the euro area before the crisis. But I wonder how they would deal with the temptations offered by Eurobonds. From a narrow academic perspective, I would argue, you know, how important are Eurobonds in terms of risk sharing? If you look at the literature on risk sharing between regions in the US, it emphasizes capital market integration and credit market integration as the more important sources of risk sharing. So where do I stand on this? Ultimately, I think we do need more fiscal risk sharing in the euro area. But over the medium term, I would put greater emphasis on other mechanisms. To me, this means improving financial crisis management and resolution. Issues such as building a European bank-specific insolvency framework and a common fiscal backstop for the banking union, just as the FDIC has here with the Treasury. It also means advancing financial integration more generally and advancing with the Europeanization of firms and banks in Europe. Now, for all of this to happen, of course, the European citizen and their political class need to be willing to buy into the euro. And this will also mean that they will need to take reforms that make their economies at the national level operate more effectively within the euro area. And that will, for some economies, mean some major political and institutional reforms. Now, for us at the IMF, this has been a very, very surprising turn of events, the whole euro area crisis. It has meant some profound changes also in the framework that we use to lend to specific countries. But overall, what we are doing vis-à-vis these countries is not so different in terms of the help that we are providing financially relative to what we have done in other cases that come before. I mean, we also had programs with advanced economies back in the 70s. It has been a process that has worked well, considering that we had to collaborate with the European Commission and the ECB, which themselves had to collaborate with many other players in Europe. And the programs that we put in place were typically put in place fairly rapidly and helped stem the problems. Where, of course, there is a big issue is that national responses could only be part of the solution, right? So there was always going to have to be an area-wide response to help national responses gain traction in terms of stabilizing the crisis. And that has been more complicated and very unusual in comparison to the experiences we've had with other countries, where it was more the IMF with a specific country. But all in all, I would sum up that so far, together with our European colleagues, we have come out reasonably well in managing the most acute problems of this crisis. Kemal, thank you very much.
Thank you. So I'll start the discussion a little bit, and then we'll go to a wider discussion. But one question I would like to ask, in a way, both of you, starting with Jean, but also Jörg. You know, one element of the crisis, I think, was the fact that current account deficits were not really considered a problem inside a monetary union. I mean, it's part of what I think Jean said, you know, of how it evolved, but he didn't quite put it that way. But there were huge current account deficits, particularly Spain, but also some of the other countries. Greece, of course, was smaller. Even Ireland had a significant current account deficit. And it only later became clear that, in a sense, even within a month, or at least in an unfinished monetary union, current account deficits are a problem because they reflect capital flows which may not be sustainable. Nobody worries, as far as I know, about the current account deficit of California, Texas, or Illinois. Nobody even knows about it. But there are other mechanisms here. The Spanish deficit reached close to 10% of GDP at point for several years. Yeah. I was always watching, you know, when Turkey might be overtaking Spain in terms of the current account deficit, and almost happened. But thankfully, we had a flexible exchange rate in Turkey. Now, okay, it seems like the crisis has been overcome, but a question that is kind of a little bit in my mind, are we now missing yet another similar problem in the sense that we have huge current account surpluses in the north, and particularly in Germany, which are partly the reason for a very strong euro, which doesn't seem to go with the weakness in the European labor markets, most of Europe. And yet, the same language is used that was used about the Spanish deficit to say, but why are you worried about the German surplus? It is, after all, a surplus in a monetary union. So that's my first question. Any views on how these current accounts should be looked at?
I think we all knew that current account deficits of the size that were observed were the symptom of something going wrong. It was a symptom of overheating in Spain and other countries. It was the counterpart of massive capital flows that were fueling a credit boom. So all that we knew, in the same way we know today that a 7% current account surplus in Germany is the symptom of not enough domestic investment in Germany, and has consequences also for the overall current account surplus of the euro, and a consequence for the exchange rate, etc. So the macro sort of things were clear before. There was a failure to act, but I think there was no mystery. Where there was a mystery was that nobody believed that a current account by itself could not be financed, a current account deficit, that suddenly you would have capital outflows as we saw. I mean, we had sudden stops in the euro area, and that nobody believed before that it could happen. The reason why it happened has to do with what you said about banks. I mean, the fact that you had suddenly investors being afraid of investing in anything having to do with Spain because they perceived that there was too much risk concentrated in the balance sheet of the Spanish bank. So basically not touching any of them anymore. And the fact that it could happen, that was not foreseen. I mean, I checked. There was one paper by Peter Garber outlining something of this sort, the possibility of a crisis within monetary union. But most of the papers, including by me, were saying, you know, it's like regions in a country. And region in a country, you don't worry about the financing of current account. You may worry about investment, or you may worry, you may ask why is there so little saving here or there, but you're not worried about...
So what about the German surplus and the Northern European surplus? Something just to live with, or is it a real issue for economic policy?
I mean, it's a real issue for, in macro terms, the asymmetric character of the adjustment, that essentially the adjustment took place in Southern Europe and not in Northern Europe, resulting in a current account surplus for the whole of the euro area, and with effect on the exchange rate, that's a problem. Now, from the German point of view, I think the debate, the interesting debate, is about why the Germany had such a high current account surplus, and what are the effects for Germany of having it. And the interesting papers suggesting that not the best use of German savings is to invest abroad, that these savings would be better invested at home.
Jörg, what do you think on this current account issue?
Fundamentally, I mean, it's hard to envisage that a surplus ever gives you problems like a deficit does, right? That's number one. So,
you meaning who?
I mean, I'm talking
about
the
surplus owner.
The surplus owner. That's what I'm talking about.
China's surplus, we all said, was a big problem for the world.
Yeah. Now, the way I characterize what happens in Europe is pretty much the same thing what happened at the world level. We didn't have a rebalancing of demand process, right? In the end, we had less demand in the deficit countries because of the contraction. This was not compensated for by more demand in the surplus countries, and the result was we settled on a slow growth path. That was the case at the global level, and the same thing is now happening at the euro area level. So we have lower growth basically everywhere, in Germany as well as in the periphery. It is, in that sense, a problem for all of these economies.
Okay. One more follow-up question, and then I turn to the... if you look forward, there's Europe, the European Union, there's the Eurozone, and the treaty says that... the Maastricht Treaty, I think, says that the currency of the European Union is the euro. Britain negotiated a formal opt-out. So did Denmark. Sweden, in a way which I never understood, doesn't have an opt-out but isn't in the euro and somehow manages it forever. But how do you see the future? Do you see 5 years, 6, 8 years from now, European Union with everybody in the Eurozone, you know, Sweden having finally decided to join and Poland coming in and the Eastern European countries, except the UK. Let's not talk about the UK because nobody thinks that they would be in. But, you know, the UK will be out of the Eurozone somehow associated with it and everybody else will be in. Or do you think that those countries that are theoretically going to be in the Eurozone, in fact, many of them may not be, and that you will have a kind of two-part Europe with the Eurozone and the non-Eurozone countries? What is the more likely scenario?
My short answer would first be ask Mr. Putin.
Ask Mr. Putin?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, because...
Let's do that.
It's only half a joke because...
Yeah, no, I know what you're saying.
Yes, I mean, and we're seeing it, that participation in the single currency is regarded as a sort of way to strengthen national security, which is interesting because it reminds me of a paper written by Adam Posen, who at the time was asking, you know, what's the difference between, why is it that the euro cannot become a global currency on par with the dollar? And his answer was because there is no army, there is no security, and that the security link associated with participation in a currency union or anchoring your currency to a certain currency is, I mean, shouldn't be underestimated. So that would be part of my answer. And what I see is that in Central and Eastern Europe, more interest in joining because of the security concern. Now, in terms of your pure economics of it, I think it's clear that some countries have decided not to join and won't join, and Sweden is part of it. And I think that's normal, but by the way, I don't think that to state in a treaty that the euro is the currency of the EU and that it means that even if you don't want to join, you have to join if you fulfill certain criteria, I think it doesn't make sense. But it has to be a decision, and a decision that is supported by the people in the country, because it implies, we've seen what it implies in terms of different adjustment, acceptance of some, sacrificing at some point something, some trade-offs.
Just to understand, but if that's so, why is it that two countries had to negotiate an opt-out?
Because they did it initially at a time where they were already undecided or decided not to join. Sweden, there was a referendum. In the end, they decided not to join. And so they don't fulfill the criteria. And among the criteria, there's one criterion, which is that you've got to have maintained a fixed exchange rate for a certain period. It's easy if you're in a floating exchange rate. You just don't fulfill the criterion. In Central and Eastern Europe, I think there's a lot of interest in, there was already a lot of interest in joining. Poland, for example, participated very constructively in discussions about many aspects. So, I think eventually they will join.
Jörg, any quick reactions to that?
Well, I mean, we have now more members of the EU area than before the crisis,
yes. Right?
Notwithstanding all that has happened. And it seems that in Central and Eastern Europe, there is appreciable buy-in in the vision of a euro area that is pretty close to the Germanic vision in terms of how economic policy should be run, right? And there was a great readiness. I mean, there was readiness to make the sacrifices, that they felt had to be made in order to be members. They shouldered the adjustments much more. I mean, it seemed to have been politically easier to effect the adjustment in these economies than in the periphery of the euro area. And so I share Jean's view that there is a greater interest now for other reasons, and that in the end that means there'll be more members.
All right, let's turn to the floor now. I'll start with you in up front, and okay. Please do identify yourself. We'll take three, four questions.
Yes, with pleasure.
My
name is, I like this Kemalistic approach. My name is Wilhelm Rissmann from the German office in the World Bank. And I have to out myself as being a fossil of the Maastricht negotiations. I was a legal advisor to Oskar at that time. So I say, okay, we did our best at that time. I think more was not possible. I think Jean has identified some deficits of the negotiation at that time. But I come from a background when in 1985 I challenged Mr. Schlesinger, who was my teacher at that time and became later on the president of the BUBA, why shouldn't we have a European currency? And he was at that time telling all his students that, well, this is the crown of European integration. That was the official BUBA read. So I was more than pleased to be a legal advisor than only 7 years later to do it. And it materialized another 8 years, 8 years later. In the meantime, we had a big mess up of market failure, market misunderstanding, political failure. Not simply to say the market did not understand that we were still separate, as has been said, countries with one money. And they made perhaps wrong bets. And to make it very short, I think the lessons learned, if you look on the scoring in the latest report of Standard & Poor's on the world reserve currencies, we can't be happy that there is so much, let's say, political misunderstanding on what to do, because otherwise the euro would skyrocket. All these basic figures about the book of the ECB are so much better than the rest of the reserve currencies that I think we had done a very, very good job in Maastricht. Thank you.
Vito. The legendary head of the fiscal department of the IMF.
Well, I'm Vito Tanzi. I was the head of the fiscal affairs department for 20 years of the fund.
If you stand up, I think people will hear you better. Yeah.
I was also a member of the Italian government at one point. I'm the author, I should reveal, I'm an author of a similar book that came out about 3-4 months ago, was finished about a year ago. It's called The Dollars, Euros, and Debt, published by a major European publisher, Macmillan. And the perspective of the book is somewhat different, you know, and it's essentially, by the way, 1 year ago when I was finishing the book around April, May of last year, I was very optimistic. In fact, the end of the book says that European Monetary Union is a great achievement and will continue forever. No, maybe forever is too long, but who knows. But the point that the book takes a different perspective, and the perspective is that the crisis was largely a fiscal crisis. You know, many of the countries cheated in many ways. You know, you mentioned Greece that cheated with accounts by a large amount, by the way, 6-7% of GDP. The Italians did the same. You know, they applied the Goodhart's law to the fiscal account. They cheated on many ways. Even the Germans did to some extent. So that the fiscal situation was very ambiguous, you know, before. And that's the first point. The crisis, to my judgment, was largely a consequence of that. They had joined a club, which was the European Monetary Union, which had clear fiscal rules, which were not respected from the beginning. The rules said that you should have zero deficit. Under crisis, you can go up to 3%. But everybody, including the French, especially the French, in fact, immediately pushed over the 3% from the beginning. But the bottom line is that this optimism about the U.S. and pessimism about the European, I have a difficult time to understand. No, the public debt of the U.S. is larger than the European Union now. No, it's the account. The U.S. is having major problems in Illinois, in California, in Michigan, etc. If those were independent countries, you call it independent country, you would have the same attention as you have to Greece. The fiscal account in the U.S. are in a mess, and especially if you take a longer perspective of it. The European Union, there have been major adjustments in Greece, in Spain, and in Portugal. Maybe in Italy, this is a little bit more questionable. We'll see what our new prime minister is going to do. But, I really don't understand this pessimism. Also, this discussion of current accounts, you know, it's true that the current, we don't know the data about what happened in Nebraska or in but the same adjustment takes place within the U.S. In fact, one of the theme of the book, there is a whole chapter comparing the monetary union of the U.S. with the monetary union of Europe, and I find that they are not a great difference. Even mobility seems to be greater in Europe than it is in the United States. Few people move in the United States. People don't know this. Those who move are the retirees who go to vacation places, and those who move less than 50 miles from the house where they live. So this kind of adjustment we talk about in the U.S. is just a dream, you know. And I'm glad you mentioned critically Feldstein. I think Feldstein did a great disservice by saying that, you know, the problem was the rule. But also the final statement that I'm finishing. The final statement is that it took 200 years for the U.S. to go from the beginning to where they are today. The European Union is only 15 years old, so give them a little bit more time.
Okay. Yes, the gentleman down back.
Yes, I'm Per Kurovsky, a European. At least since last Monday, I had a little intermezzo there in my passport issue. as a young and in Sweden, we heard in the churches all the time, quite frequently, psalms that sang, that prayed for God make us daring. And risk-taking is definitely something that has made and created Europe. Now, in June 2004, the Basel Committee introduced capital requirements that really subsidized risk aversion and taxed risk-taking. And those capital requirements, for instance, for a German bank, if we wanted to lend to a German businessman, 8% capital, if he wanted to lend to Greece, zero. Those capital requirements distorted the allocation of bank credit in all Europe. It's not mentioned in the book. If you have a comment, please.
Okay. I take one more. Yeah, I think the gentleman here in the middle. Okay, I will take. You also want. Okay. Here. Yes, this one. Sorry for being the guy who has to choose.
Thank you. Kevin Conroy from the.
Quick.
Kevin Conroy from the Irish Embassy. I was interested in the idea that you've both mentioned that maybe it would have been different if Ireland had been first into the lion's den, but I suppose I just want to cast some doubt on that idea. I think the crisis resolution phase went on for long enough to realize that the problem became an existential threat to the euro itself, and the decision-making and resolution phases still took a lot of pain, suffering, political hesitation in many capitals, including in the most important capitals. So I don't really buy the idea that if Ireland had been the first in, that it would have been handled much differently. And secondly, I think the question about the surpluses that you started with goes to the heart of the future of this. I mean, what's Europe going to do about jobs and growth? And we've been listening for years to our Lisbon agenda being trotted out and European councils dedicated to jobs and growth. We still ain't getting there 20 years on. So that's really the bigger question. The improvements in banking union and fiscal management, all of the solutions which you've given a B+2 in the discussion are all very good. But fundamentally, it's what kind of economic space does Europe want, and what are Europe's leaders prepared to really do to make the European Union part of the engine rather than presiding over an economy that fails to produce the kind of growth and jobs that are necessary. Thanks. Okay.
One more question, then we turn to.
Hello, I'm Sandrine Rastello with Bloomberg. I was wondering, going forward, if there was to be any more joint bailout in the Eurozone, do you think the Troika or whatever would replace it? What should be necessary to change? We know there's been a lot of tension, including recently regarding the bank recaps in Greece. So what would you say should be changed or tweaked? And that's it.
Jörg, maybe you go first this time, and then we.
Just yeah, good.
You pick whichever you want to.
Yeah, I mean, briefly. So I think I heard the hypothesis here. Strong euro means Maastricht has been a success. I think if you are a bondholder, yes. Especially if you are holding German bonds and French bonds, you know, with the interest rates having come down so much, you're sitting on a handful of capital gains. If for you, very low inflation between 1 and 2% is very important because maybe you have a fixed pension or fixed income or whatever, you're doing great. If you are someone else, then I think it is a little more mixed, to put it mildly. So I think, the euro has delivered low inflation and it has delivered low interest rates and a strong currency, but it has not delivered on a number of other fronts. On the crisis being largely a fiscal crisis, I think I think we differ. We simply differ, and we've laid out the reasons. True, the governments didn't have balance over the medium term, fiscal balance over the medium term, which was an objective of the Stability and Growth Pact. But the failures in the private sector were of such an order of magnitude. I mean, you're talking now about debts having been raised by 20% of GDP or so, that, you know, this additional buffer that you would have had by having your fiscal before the crisis in balance, mind you, I think the average deficit in the euro area in 2008 was 1.5% or so, it wouldn't have made a big difference. I just don't believe it would, because they were literally floored by the debts from the private sector, which were pushed onto sovereign balance sheets. The capital requirements, taxing entrepreneurs, the capital requirements, 8%, you know, on entrepreneurs, 0% on governments. You raise a good question there. It really revolves, an answer to this revolves around, do you believe that government has a stabilizing function in the economy, right? Do you believe that a government is fundamentally something good to have around? If that's your belief, then it doesn't make sense necessarily to
ask for capital requirements on purchases of government debt, because you believe that the government in the end has to have the ability to act as a stabilizer when the private sector is taking flight from risk, right? That's when the government has to be able to step in. And the last thing we want is then for all people to also dump government assets and basically, I don't know what they would do, buy gold. So it's a good issue. If on the other hand, your concern, if your view is that the government is the problem, right, then you would want to have a capital requirement on it. So it depends on where you stand. I think the issue of the government being the problem was very much a story of the 1970s and to some extent 1980s. The problems we are dealing with now are more problems in the private sector. We are dealing with excesses in private lending and borrowing, and it proves very hard for us to get a handle on these. You know, we're having hopes for macroprudential instruments, but they are untested, and only the future will show how we deal with them when new credit booms evolve. Then on making Europe an engine of growth, it's absolutely true. Stabilization has been achieved. Now it is about getting back to growth. As I said, the large increase in the current account surplus of the euro area, and especially Germany, is a symptom of low growth, of a problem that needs to be addressed. Part of addressing the problem is, of course, to get to policies that are sufficiently supportive on the macroeconomic front. Let me leave it at that, okay. Kemal, and pass the floor to Jean.
Okay, that I agree with most of what you said. So let me just compliment on to Vito. I would add the following. I could agree that the fiscal surveillance is much too much based on some simple guideposts and not doesn't take risk into account sufficiently. I would be interested in having an approach that looks at what are the risks for public finances. Because in my view, what really mattered was that in the course of 2 years, countries could move from a surplus to a sort of 11% or 9% deficit, like Spain, Ireland also. The situation can deteriorate extremely fast. And so if you want to focus on the fiscal surveillance, then you have to take into account those risks and not have such a very deterministic approach of fiscal discipline that implicitly assume that the problem is going from 2 to 3% to 4%, and then you can control along the road. I mean, the materialization of fiscal risk has been very different from what was envisaged. On Ireland, the only thing I said was that the fact that the crisis happened first in Greece affected the perception by public opinion, and I think that remains correct. The image was the Greek. In Germany, this image was a Greek pensioner getting pension that are much more generous than in Germany. There was the people, the Greek doctors not paying taxes, etc. So it was essentially, when the crisis happened, the image that remained was this image of a country not playing by the rules. And had it been a country that played by the rules, inevitably this would have raised questions about what are the causes of this crisis, what the private behavior that gave rise to it, where is the system deficient, because you couldn't have blamed the country for not having played by the rules. So it does not to say that, solving the Irish case, and there were not a number of questions about the Irish crisis that were very difficult by themselves, and the whole question of the bailing in of foreign banks, etc., that would have remained in a bone of contention. But I was speaking of public perception. On job and growth, I strongly agree. That's an essential part of the issue. Now, on the Troika, when I was at Bruegel, we published a study on the Troika, and there was a recent update. Basically, what we were saying is that, first of all, it was necessary to have the IMF participating. I think all the experience of the adjustment program showed that it was indispensable, that simply the EU didn't have the technology to deal with such problems. That the institutional setup was what it was. I mean, it was strange. I think the ECB, there are questions about the role of the ECB, because the central bank normally sits on the other side of the table. The role of the ECB in the Troika is much less clear than the role of the Commission and the role of the IMF, which are both, you know, part of the negotiation of specific conditionality. The ECB, you don't know exactly why it is there. And when you discuss with people, they tell you it's because the ECB needs to gather information by being part of the Troika, which is not a very good explanation. Now, on the Commission side, I think the question now, having gained much more experience, the question is, what should be the role going forward, assuming we would go forward with some other experience of the state, what should be the relative role of the IMF and the Commission? What we said in this report was that it would be better for the IMF to be able to walk out without jeopardizing completely the program, so to be more of a catalytic lender that could decide whether to join or not. This sort of relationship between IMF and Commission being both part and being both necessary component of the financial assistance is a bit awkward. And finally, on the Commission side, it would be better not to have, I mean, the Commission institutionally is in a very strange position also, because as an institution, it does not take responsibility for the program. So in the eyes of public opinion of everybody, Commission is a very important part of the negotiation. At the same time, the Commission as a body doesn't take responsibility for it. So it would be better to have, you know, Commission staff seconded to the ESM, the ESM taking responsibility, meaning that the ESM would be turned into a sort of European Monetary Fund.
Yeah, I mean, that the last point I think is very, the ESM, I mean, if the ESM had those, it would look much more like the IMF for Europe, right? Okay, yes, you're right. And then I wonder, Liaquat, if I can entice you, because few people have written so wonderfully about central banks, but and central bank played such a huge role. So some words on that and some, okay. Yeah.
Thanks, Kamal. I'm Randy Henning at American University. I wanted to ask Jean to elaborate a little bit on your preferences about political integration as we move forward. Jorg Asmussen was in town at a conference a month ago, and he suggested that kind of the way forward was to recreate, essentially, I'm paraphrasing a little, was to recreate within the euro area the institutions that we have within the European Union, kind of building on the ESM, only making it replicating the community method within the euro area rather than intergovernmentalism. This strikes me as a way forward, but it's a break from the putting all the eggs in the EU basket. Are you ready to do that? Is that the path that you prefer? And my question for Jorg was about the European Central Bank. Many of us would like to see another big round of quantitative easing in the ECB. But what do you think the ECB should buy? Would be my question to you. I ask because I know you've given this a lot of thought.
Okay. Thank you very much. And let me turn to Liaquat to say a few words, also maybe in linking to the role of the ECB. By the way, is it the European Central Bank or the Eurozone Central Bank? That's a question I always ask myself.
Well, I'm not going to make any comments, actually. I'm going to ask a question. I had always understood central banks as essentially providers of liquidity in the case of a liquidity crisis. Now, as I look at Europe, it seems much closer to a solvency crisis than a liquidity crisis. I read all these articles about target two balances and this hidden debt that countries or the national central banks continue to owe to the ECB. And I'm just asking, did the ECB in many ways overstep its true mandate? And how are they going to wind down these large intra-European central bank debts?
Should we go?
No.
Okay. Two important questions. So, Randy,
To me, first of all, we should be careful to do whatever we have to do for the euro area, but not to destroy the EU in the process. That's a fine balance. I think this is one thing that worked very well. It could have worked very badly, but the relationship between the EU and euro area, non-euro area and euro area members has been smooth, mostly, not always, but mostly throughout the crisis. And I think we should thank the Brits for having played a very constructive role in this respect, having realized at some point time that their national interest was that the euro survives, and that having, being cooperative in helping the euro area countries to forge solution, not using their power to block. Banking union being a good example, I think the clearest example. Now, that being said, there is a question for the euro area about political integration, which in my view comes from the fact that we could have chosen the federal route for the way we addressed a number of crisis problems. We could have relied more on the sort of traditional community philosophy. What has been done is the opposite, to build a different system, that it's much more a system based on a system of mutual support and mutual assistance among countries. The FSF was a sort of prime example of a construct of this sort. And in the process, an important consequence has been that national parliaments have become players, and very important players in some cases, because basically the national parliaments are in control of the funds that were used. I mean, they're controlling this way the SM. So we've moved away from the traditional model and went into a model that relies much more sort of institutionalized cooperation between participating countries. Now we have to, solve this contradiction. Do we want to continue on this track and what it implies? In my view, it would imply something like creating a sort of chamber for the euro area, building on national parliaments and representation of national parliaments. Or do you want to go back, return to the sort of more community approach, which would mean that we would have gradually to transform and to absorb all these new instruments into the EU? I think there is a lot of hesitation at the moment. Both are conceivable, but there is a need for clarity. To Liaquat, I think I disagree with you. I think we had much more of a liquidity crisis than what you said. I think the solvency crisis was essentially the Greek crisis. You could argue about certain other cases. But what we've seen is essentially that at some point, the interbank market was not providing liquidity to banks located in a certain number of countries, and that the central bank did exactly what the central bank had to do, to provide liquidity to those banks. And the consequence of that has been this buildup of target imbalances. But that's the counterpart of the central bank playing exactly the role that you expect a central bank to do. So I think I don't have the same reading.
Could I just ask, why do you say it's a solvency crisis, Liaquat? Can you clarify that, the reason for that? Because that will make the...
I mean, the tricky thing in when you look at sovereign debt is the distinction between a liquidity crisis and solvency crisis is always a gray area. But as I understand it, if you looked at how much the Irish banks were borrowing through the Irish Central Bank and then from the ECB, you were talking about 60-70% of GDP at the time. Now, to accumulate foreign debts of that amount on top of the other foreign debts that are counted in the debt statistics strikes me as Ireland facing a major debt problem, which is much closer to a solvency crisis than a liquidity crisis. And so it's going to take a long time to unwind those target two balances.
The target two balances are mostly the counterpart of massive capital outflows, right? Those countries, they had private capital inflows, and those capital inflows built up, and then there were sudden capital outflows. This was replaced almost entirely by target two balances. I mean, the rest.
That capital is not coming back, is it?
Well, marginally. I mean, the target two balances have diminished from I think 800 maximum to the German maximum balance was I think 700-800 billion. It's down to 500 or something of this sort. So they are diminishing gradually, but we are far from having returned to a normal situation.
Can I intervene just using the prerogative of the chair? I mean, isn't the real debate whether the current accounts that are sustainable, normal, like in Spain, maybe 3% of GDP deficit, can be reconciled with a country like Spain again growing at 2.5-3% a year? Because, you know, that would be resolving the solvency problem. I mean, in a way, I think you seem like you've solved it now. It may be solved by having depressed demand, particularly import demand, to a point where there is no more current account deficit. Mm-hmm. Okay, but these countries cannot continue like this. They need to grow. They need to generate employment. At that point, if the current account deficits reappear, have they become sustainable, or have we just provided enough liquidity to stem the crisis, but in fact the structural adjustment that would make Spain grow at 2 or 3% with a reasonable current account deficit that's financed normally, are we there? I mean, that's what's behind those balances, I think.
Well, I wouldn't see it as impossible. I would be a bit more cautious about the level of the current account deficit that a country like Spain can have going forward, because I think the level of external liabilities is quite high. And so, you know, the question is, what's sustainable in flow terms?
But it's a very kind of sad commentary that markets and many economists felt that 9-10% was fine 5 years ago, right? And now we're saying that Spain cannot even have 2%. You may be right, but Jörg, any final words?
Well, on this, I like to look at that through the prism of the net international investment position of a country, right? And in the periphery, like Ireland and Portugal, Greece, in various of these economies, you know, no one should quote me on this, but it's around 100% of GDP, which means, you know, there is every year going to be a very significant transfer of national resources abroad, you know. Fortunately, interest rates are fairly low, right? And so the transfer is limited. But there is a big transfer abroad. It is also clear that at this stage, there's very little scope for these current account deficits, also considering the net international investment positions, to reemerge and become wide again, right? So what does it mean for these countries? It means that in their new growth, they have to develop growth in the tradable sector, right? And the question is, are they ready to implement the structural reforms that are needed to foster the growth rate of the tradable sector? And I think on various fronts, we have seen some good progress, I mean, with reforms in the labor market. Maybe, you know, also some reforms in the product markets, but maybe lagging those that have taken place in the labor market. But there certainly is more to be done so that they can then again, within their tight budget constraints, grow at a satisfactory pace. There's nothing that says, simply because you cannot run a current account deficit, you're doomed to have a low growth rate. It's nothing like that, right? And there's nothing that says, you know, your 80% or 100% net international investment position is unsustainable, right? You're going to explode, right? It is a function of how policy responds.
All right, I think we have to close. Thank you all so much. Thank you, Jörg and Jean. Thanks a lot.
Thanks
to everybody for coming also.